At last, the final part, ominous parallels. This concludes it. In a way, I want to apologize for tearing off on a rant during the last ominous parallels, but I mean, I would rather not have done it, but that's it. I mean, I did it. I wish I could have bottled it for another time, but I have no problem whatsoever about the remarks. And it's not necessarily that I'm upset with Peikoff and everything. I mean, some of the things that were mentioned in that last part, it's just the way it is. You know, that he believes that politicians are still the answer. You know, I'm sorry, folks, but as long as you keep voting and thinking it really means something, you can vote, do whatever you want. I mean, you can waste your time any way you want to. Like I said, I'd like to see nobody vote and pay their taxes. And what would happen? You still have guys winning, politicians winning, like by 7 million votes. Doesn't matter if you vote or not. They'll go ahead and give you the tabulation anyway. Is that too jaded? Don't think it is. And don't pay your income taxes. Let's not all of us pay our income taxes next year. What would they do then? Well, everything would still happen, just like the voting would, except then they would pick out a percentage of people and make examples out of them, and everybody would shit a brick and pay all their taxes. And by the way, I won't go any further. Let it go at that. But I'm just telling you, politics ain't the answer. The final installment of Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America. It's a good book. Man, all right. Kind of going to miss it. I own it, but I'm going to give it away. In 1933, a voice congenial to the writers and artists took over. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, invoking an old ethics, offered the country a new deal. The nation, declared Roosevelt, is in his first inaugural address, must act, quote, as a trained and local army willing to sacrifice for the good of a common discipline. Right. As a result of the status foundation and the economic catastrophe they inherited, the New Dealers could afford to be more explicit than their predecessors in the reformist movement. Quote, and this is from sociologist Henry Pratt Fairchild, whether we like it or not, modern life has become so highly integrated, so inextricably socialized, so definitely organic, that the very concept of the individual is becoming obsolete. Wouldn't call it organic, though, but anyway. It seemed at the time to be unanimous. The progressive educators abruptly shifted their emphasis from the earlier child-centered orientation to a community-centered version. The fiction writers wrote USA, or The Grapes of Wrath, or Waiting for Lefty. The union leader, how repeatedly, strike, strike, strike. The churches, according to a group representing the major Protestant denominations, quote, protest against the selfish desire for wealth as the principal motive of industry. Seek a social order which shall be based upon Jesus' principles of love and brotherhood, and therefore offer hearty support of a planned economic system. Oh, that is so bad on so many levels. Even the skeptics joined in. There is nothing peculiarly sacred about American folklore, such as capitalism or the Constitution, said Thurman Arnold, a Yale law professor who typifies the increasingly pragmatic approach of the later New Deal. We need not rush to theories and principles as guides, said Arnold, who soon moved to Washington to serve as head of the antitrust division of the Justice Department. The absolutists knew what was absolute. The relativists knew how to dispense with it. Some were dogmatists and some were pragmatists, but all were working toward the same kind of end. The New Dealers did not lavish praise on Germany. They were warmer to Mussolini's Italy. For most of them, however, the real beacon was elsewhere. The future, said Rexford Tugwell, is becoming visible in Russia. The present is bitterly in contrast. The 30s have been described correctly as America's red decade. The communist influence on the country's intellectuals and on the New Deal was palpable. Communism, however, was not the decisive causal factor. It was merely one fashionable expression of the ideas advocated by every major group. If Americans were to, quote, reconstruct society properly, wrote John Dewey at the start of the Depression, it would signify that we had entered constructively and voluntarily upon the road which Soviet Russia is traveling with so much attendant destruction and coercion. Dewey was not a Marxist. He described himself as a liberal Democrat. He disagreed with the Bolsheviks on the method of travel, but not on the road or direction. Dewey did not fear that the end of the road would have to be the same in America as in Russia. There are no absolutes, he said. Reality is inherently unfinished. We can know where a course will take us, he said, only after we have acted. Sound familiar? The political program of the New Deal centered on a goal that had been endorsed but not stressed by the progressives. The Democrats demanded federal action to achieve equality, equality of opportunity. Besides the traditional constitutional rights, which were political in nature, they said men also have economic rights. The Founding Fathers had conceived rights as entitlements to act and to keep the products of one's actions, not as claims to the actions or products of others. Equality, in the original American view, meant the right of every man to independence, to make his way and sustain his life by his own effort. Opportunity meant freedom. The New Dealers rejected this approach as unfeeling and cruel. A hungry man, they said, is not free. In any way, they said, freedom is not enough. Talk of liberty in reform circles now was likely to produce a yawn, if not a scowl, writes one historian. Opportunity was the point. I'm not even going to get into this whole thing about the Founding Fathers and what Peikoff, you know, buys as the same bullshit that everybody does who goes through school. Moving on, from President Roosevelt, every man has a right to life, and this means that he has also a right to make a comfortable living. The government, therefore, must provide the citizens with appropriate jobs. It, quote, owes to everyone an avenue to possess himself of a portion of the American plenty sufficient for his needs through his own work. As to the men whose thought and action had made the plenty possible, Roosevelt said, in the future we are going to think less about the producer and more about the consumer. It was safe to say it. The mind, Dewey had taught a generation, is not a private possession, but a social asset. The New Dealers never offered a fixed definition of opportunity as they conceived the term. From their actions, however, it was apparent that the word could be extended beyond the issue of jobs to cover a series of economic rights and of government powers which never stopped growing. Two swelling streams poured out of Washington, the stream of federal favors and the stream of federal controls. The experimenting fingers of the New Deal were everywhere, providing funds or programs for every major group, including the unemployed, the young, the writers and artists, the workers, the businessmen, the farmers. The biggest beneficiaries were the unions. As a result of laws such as the Wagner Act, organized labor was converted from the status of voluntary association to that of quasi-official, government-mandated spokesman and bargaining agent for the worker. The experimenting fingers also repudiated the gold standard, moved to regiment agriculture, imposed new controls on the banks, created a commission to supervise the stock market, right, pressed the more vigorous antitrust policy, and then try to force businessmen into a system of industry-wide government-regulated cartels. And in parentheses, he writes, the National Industrial Recovery Act. The NRA was the New Deal's attempt to bring to America the substance of Mussolini's corporativism. Well, it did. Not Mussolini's fault. This was the plan, and it still is the plan. Some of the New Deal measures, such as the NRA, did not last. The essential policies underlying the measures, however, did last. With the passage of the Social Security Act, which provided for compulsory old age and unemployment insurance, the United States caught up with Europe. By 1935, 5 decades after Bismarck had inaugurated the idea, America, too, had become a welfare state. The New Deal measures had to be conceived, guided through Congress, ran through the courts, administrated, enforced, financed. Thus, the appearance of some corollaries of Bismarckianism, try to say that twice, the leap in executive power, the growth of the bureaucracy, the mounting debt, the skyrocketing taxes. Since each group's benefits required some other group's sacrifice, there was a further corollary. The rise of nationwide pressure group warfare. To compare the New Deal with any European version of statism, its champion said at the time, is ridiculous. This administration, they said, is not wedded to a particular ideology. Roosevelt's concentration of power in government in government hands is not doctrinaire but pragmatic. Such concentration, they added, is no threat to liberty, because the government here is using its power to cut down economic royalists and thus promote the welfare of the common man. In fact, said President Roosevelt in the 1932 campaign, the purpose of government restrictions is, quote, not to hamper individualism, but to protect it. Gag here. Roosevelt said, speaking to a Chicago audience in 1936, it was this administration which saved the system of private profit and free enterprise. Yeah, right. If you're from New York, how come you sound like you're from, like, Massachusetts? All right. The conservatives of the period furiously opposed to Roosevelt, attacked every feature of the New Deal except its ideological essence. They decried its breach with tradition, the tradition of Herbert Hoover. Oh, he had one? They denounced it as unconstitutional but stopped short of offering any defense of the Constitution's principles or philosophic base. What a surprise. Some denounced the democratic innovations as a product of science or the sin of pride, while affirming that the foundation of America was faith and the virtue of humility. All of them attacked Roosevelt as a menace to individual liberty, while stressing that their own ideal was the Christian ethics of service and duty to those in need. It was a spectacle of rage laced with appeasement, a combination not calculated to swell the conservative ranks. And here we have a block quote. Every person who lives by any useful work should be habituated to regard himself not as an individual working for his private benefit, but as a public functionary, and his wages of whatever sort, not as the remuneration or purchase money of his labor, which should be given freely, but as the provision made by society to enable him to carry it on. The author of this statement, more extreme a collectivist utterance than any Democratic politician would permit himself in public, was not a New Dealer. It was John Stuart Mill, a philosophic hero of the conservatives of the time. As in the 1890s, so in the 1930s, both sides in the political battle held the same basic ideas, and so the conservatives were helpless. By the later 30s, the conservative attacks on Roosevelt began to peter out, and the debate, such as it had been, was over. The Republican leadership, bowing to the trend, adopted a permanent policy of me-tooing the Democrats. Judged by the standard its leaders publicly set themselves, the restoration of employment and prosperity, the New Deal was a failure. At the end of the 30s, there were still 10 million people unemployed, about two-thirds of the number without jobs in 1932. The problem was not solved until the excess manpower was sent to die on foreign battlefields. When in doubt, start a fight. Once again, a period of rising statism in the West was climaxed by a world war. Once again, the American public, which was strongly isolationist, was manipulated by a pro-war administration into joining an idealistic crusade. On November 27, 1941, 10 days before Pearl Harbor, writes John T. Flynn, quote, the president told Secretary Stimson, who wrote it in his diary, that our course was to maneuver the Japanese into attacking us. This would put us into the war and solve his problem. That's true, and we won't go into that right now. The result of the First Crusade had not been a world safe for democracy, but the emergence of modern totalitarianism. The result of the Second Crusade was not the attainment of four freedoms, but the surrender of half of Europe to Soviet Russia. From the founding of the United States through the 1920s, the private sector, as it is now called, was the nation's dominant element. The state and the principle of statism were always encroaching, but always peripheral. The New Deal, including its progeny of wartime controls and its Fair Deal successor, ended this historical relationship. After two Roosevelts, America was no longer an essentially capitalist country with a sprinkling of controls, nor was it a socialist country. It was and still is a modern, mixed economy with a philosophic base and the political future that this implies. In a mixed economy, one of the two elements gradually withers away. That element is not the state. And I'll tell you right now, if that's true about a mixed economy, here's what I've always looked at it as. And that is, we get the worst aspects of capitalism and the worst aspects of socialism. Think about it. Moving on. America had beaten the fascists. Had we really? It had stamped out Hitler. Mm-hmm. But it was turning into the Weimar Republic. And that is, as far as I'm going with this book, The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America, written by Leonard Peikoff. Ayn Rand did write an introduction. She obviously was alive in 1982 when this was first published. Now, what struck me, if I can remember all those years ago, about this book was the fact that Peikoff got it right in what we were becoming. It's interesting that he would know that unless he was, you know, fed that to Wright. I'm not going to get into that. But he was right. He called it right. And yet, somehow, some way, and maybe to this day, I mean, I talked, you know, contacted him, I don't know, around 2004, 2005 at the latest. And I really don't know if he still feels the same way today. I assume he does. I think from what I read, you know, he still thinks you can win at the ballot box, which we cannot. So the whole game is rigged, and he didn't want to take it that far, perhaps because he didn't believe it went that far. And you folks are going to have to decide that for yourselves. Now, as we sit here now, we're looking at further statism, which is going to be the case, less individual thinking, less individual liberty, shall we say, sacrifice for the good of the commonweal, the group, wherever you should be, whether it's in public school, whether it's in college. Oh, it's the group this, the group that. We don't want any individualists out there. And I'm not going to go any further, but I'm going to do another stuff and things. Listen to what I have to say over there, if you don't mind. In the meantime, I'm not going to belabor this anymore. Peikoff got it right. Would have liked to have talked to him the last couple of years. Didn't work out. But yes, we are becoming what we hated, or as we're doing with Larry the Contractor Guy's work, and that is we are what we hated. I hope you listened to it all. If not, sorry for dragging it out like I did, but some things could not be avoided. And so here you have it, the end of the Ominous Parallel series. See you around.